Hello and welcome to another episode of Dice Exploder. Each week we take a tabletop mechanic and see if we remembered to drop a pin for where it is. My name is Sam Dunnewald and my co-host today is Tim Dene. The big game this month in my part of the RPG world is Blades 68, a reimagining of Blades in the Dark set 100 plus years after the original, and in the style of the swingin' 60s. Thinking about Blades 68 in the context of last week's episode with Nova about Duskvall's lightning barriers, the enormous electric fences in the world of Blades that keep ghosts out of the city and, more importantly, prevent players from taking their hardened criminal characters on the run without serious consequences. If the thesis of that episode was, hey, the fiction of your game matters a lot and can even have mechanical effects, I thought it'd be compelling to take that idea and see what Blade 68 was doing with it. When you completely reinvent the setting, how do you think about what parts of the fiction are important and need to be kept versus what parts should evolve and change? To do that, this week I'm joined by the designer of Blade 68, Tim Dene. Tim is a graphic designer, cartographer, and game designer. You might know him from Deathmatch Island or the big detailed maps of Duskvall he put out a few years ago, and he's got a lot of smart stuff to say about all of this. My resolution this year has been to get Dice Exploder back to basics, really center in on the one mechanic in episode format, and so I still wanted to find some mechanic for us to use as a way into this conversation. And knowing Tim's past work, I picked an old classic from Dungeon World, draw maps, leave blanks. It's a DM principle, which makes it half rule and half advice in an interesting way. It's also spun out well beyond its original context in Dungeon World, and we get into all that. What this meant to start, what it's come to mean more broadly, and how we've applied it at the table both as designers and as players. So let's get into it. Thanks to everyone who supports Dice Exploder on Patreon, and here is Tim Dene with draw maps, leave blanks. From Dungeon World. Tim Dene, thanks for being on Dice Exploder. Welcome.
Hi, kia ora. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So you are here in part because this show loves Blades in the Dark and Blades in 68, or maybe just Blades 68. It's live right now on Kickstarter. People should go back it. But I really wanted to have you on specifically to like talk about the design process of that game and like the idea of building on top of so much like pre-established like fiction. And the thing, the like mechanic I wanted to kind of bring as like an end to that is it takes us back to Dungeon World. So let's start with Dungeon World. Do you know about Dungeon World? What's your deal with Dungeon World? Do you know anything about this game?
I do have a history with Dungeon World. Because I played role-playing games as a teenager and then kind of stopped for a while and came back with 5th edition, like a lot of people. And then one of my off-ramps back off D&D and back into indie RPGs was Dungeon World. And so, yeah, it was very formative in kind of my conception of indie RPGs, and I played a lot of Dungeon World and listened to all those Friends of the Table episodes and have a lot of Dungeon World feelings for sure.
Yeah. Well, that's good, because I haven't ever actually played this game. I've, like, read Dungeon World. I know it's, like, you know, it's kind of a seminal game for a lot of people. The story you just told is, I think, like, so... I've heard it a lot of times from a lot of friends. And I've maybe played a one-shot or something. I find it really interesting, but it has this mechanic that I think has blossomed out, like, grown beyond the game into sort of, like, larger advice about playing role-playing games that I wanted to kind of focus on here. And that is... the MC, I guess the Dungeon Master principle, draw maps, leave blanks. So I'm going to start here by just like reading out what it says in the book about this. And then I kind of want to maybe ask you about like what this meant to you while playing Dungeon World. So in the book, it says, draw maps, leave blanks. Dungeon World exists mostly in the imaginations of the people playing it. Maps help everyone stay on the same page. You won't always be drawing them yourself, but anytime there's a new location described, make sure it gets added to a map. When you draw a map, don't try to make it complete. Leave room for the unknown. As you play, you'll get more ideas, and the players will give you inspiration to work with. Let the maps expand and change. So, yeah, how do you feel about this? You're a map guy. You made these like big maps for Blades in the Dark that we'll talk about later, but like playing Dungeon World, how did this actually play out at the table for you?
Yeah, this piece of advice did stick in my mind. I did a lot of D&D maps as well. I even had a D&D map Tumblr that got a lot of followers, and I've always been like both a real world map person. I did an atlas, and I've also done a lot of RPG maps. And so, I mean, it's true that this principle or whatever it is was very provocative to me and challenging.
Where were you at when you first read it that you became challenged by it?
Well, I think I probably first heard it because Austin Walker always starts each Friends at the Table episode with reading out some of the principles and that kind of thing. You know, I'm sort of neurotic enough that it kind of made me feel like I was doing things wrong, or like I had to fight against my own impulses to some extent. Like I sort of knew my impulse is to just draw maps and not leave blanks. So you kind of want to go in the opposite direction because you know you have this temptation and you're getting this advice and you want to try to do things a different way. And so I probably went too far the other way and just wanted, became sort of obsessed about the blanks. I sort of forbid myself to map at all. I took it the other way because I knew if I allowed myself to slip like some kind of addict that I would quickly map too much. And over time, I think I'm happy with where I've come to in the middle. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting looking back. It's very map specific and also like play to find out. It kind of has a sort of, like it's a little bit cryptic and kind of fortune cookie wisdom-ish, like draw maps, leave blanks. Yeah, like it, in a way that's saying like do enough but not too much. Like it's sort of meaningless in some ways.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's like two contradictory pieces of advice at once, right? Because I was very much coming from, and still am in a lot of ways, like coming from the opposite place you're talking about. Like I didn't draw maps enough. And every time I draw a map, I'm like, this is great. Why am I not doing this all the time? This rules. And like, I'm thinking right now about like, I'm playing Apocalypse World campaign and we like drew a little map of the town, like in our sixth session or something. And suddenly the whole place felt so much more real. And like everyone started engaging with the town more. And I'm thinking right now about like all the things I need to add to that map that like still aren't on that map, even though we've played another like three sessions since then. Right. And yeah, so that version of it, the first part is very trivial, right? It's like, maybe you try this out. Maybe you do the maps thing. But yeah, you're right that it's contradictory in that way. And then I think that like turning the dial on like, when are you listening to which half of this slogan is a matter of experimentation, but also taste and context.
Yeah. And I do think it has a lot of value in that sense. Like it's really saying like interrogate each choice. Like maybe you should draw more maps or maybe you should have more blanks because there is value to each of them. Like in a way, play to find out, although amazing advice, has become so widespread, I think it does start to become a bit meaningless, not to critique that piece of advice, but it starts to become just, you know, things will happen at the table in a sense, which is like, sure they will.
You really need to be knowing play to find out what, like what is the question you're playing to find out an answer to, right?
Yeah. And read the rest of Apocalypse World because it's all in a context. Like it's not just play to find out what happens. I was interested in the precedence of this draw maps, leave blanks. And so I did look at a few older games and like some of the Ron Edwards games and Troll Babe and some other stuff. I don't think there's like a direct precedent, but what I did find is in first edition Apocalypse World, on page 121, there's a few more things to do, which I don't think is in later editions.
Oh, I've not read first edition, but I have read second edition, and that the draw maps like anything is in exactly that section in second edition. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Yeah. It says make maps like crazy, have the players make maps like crazy too, and sketches and diagrams and any kind of ephemera that seems good. And I do wonder if this is like, obviously when Dungeon World came out after Apocalypse World, and I'm sure they would have like referred back to Apocalypse World to decide what to write and what advice to include. And I do wonder if this is a sort of reaction to that advice to some extent, or trying to...
Well, it's so much the like D&D fantasy genre is such like a map making genre, you know, like it's such a classic thing to be making a map of the dungeon as you're going through the dungeon crawl, right? I think it probably does make a lot of sense to take that piece of advice that's already in Apocalypse World and be like, okay, but for this game, we're going to name it more, underline it more.
Add a caveat. Exactly. Yeah.
I find there's a whole other episode. I did a blog post about this a long time ago, but like about what's a principle in your game. Like, what are you calling a principle and what's just like a few more things to do? And like, what's the difference there? Is there a difference there? But
And then the agenda,
yeah,
too, right?
Exactly. Like, it's all blurry, just kind of like pretty good advice. I don't know. I've got another episode coming up in a couple of weeks here that's about where's the line between advice for playing and rules of the game, and like when do you put something on one side of the line, so people can look forward to that. That's about gumshoe. That's about the like always give them the clue, right? Like that's good advice, even though sometimes it's a rule. There was something I was thinking about when you were talking in here about draw maps, leave blanks, of how there is kind of a call to action in here to be open to whatever's coming to you. This principle is inviting you to keep an open mind, to just experiment and to try things out, to play with that dial of where things are, and don't be a control freak who needs to have everything mapped out down to the street, Tim. And like, also don't do the other thing. Don't be Sam. Don't like forget to bring paper to draw maps onto the table either. And I think that like, that kind of gentle pushing in a very, very specific context is like a neat little thing that's going on here.
Totally. And that gets to what makes this such a little powerful piece of advice is obviously it's about maps, specifically actual maps, but that very quickly transfers into like prep and legwork or whatever you want to call it, like the...
Well, yeah, it's just to be specific about it, it's really easy to take this and to apply it to NPCs, right? If you really want to know, like I'm playing in a play-by-post game right now where one of the people is in charge of like playing, you know, a couple of dozen different characters, and she really loves just like writing several page backstory for each of those NPCs, including the half of them that haven't appeared on camera after 3 months, right? And like, that's great, like, you know, more power to you if like that's what you're enjoying, but also you want to leave some blanks in there too, maybe, you know, for like when they show up and like collide with the story that's going on, and you know, adjusting. And again, that's all like a matter of taste of how it's exactly the same thing, just with like NPC backstory and getting familiar with the characters and on and on and on to other subjects.
I mean, as a big map person, I've totally had that experience of over prepping and over mapping, and then in the session it is like a claustrophobic feeling sometimes, like there's too many walls around you and you want to just like stretch your legs and follow your narrative impulses, but there's you put all these, it's like there's too much furniture in the room and you keep tripping over it. Like,
yeah, totally. That's a great way to describe it. Yeah. Another thing I want to just like touch on here, like revisiting the actual text of Dungeon World with this piece of advice, because it had taken on so much of a life of its own. You talked about like thinking, you know, you'd forgotten it wasn't draw maps, leave blank spaces. But for me, I'd forgotten that it was about literally drawing maps in the first place. like it really, I'd taken the advice much more in the like NPC direction, like in that prep direction, in that like, how do you think like more conceptually? And it was really like relieving in a way to come back and have such like concrete version of this advice.
Yeah, totally. And again, I think that's pretty common experience. Like to go back to Friends at the Table, I think they had a Patreon podcast, I think about Austin's prep work that was called Drawing Maps. And so that's taking this piece of advice and taking half of that and making it about prep. And I think that's a very common way to do it. And I totally had it the same in my head. Like for me, it was prep advice and not specifically about maps.
Okay, so we've been talking about how where you end up on the size of your maps and the size of your blanks is like kind of this matter of taste. What's your taste? Like when you think about this principle, when you think about your actual play, where are you thinking about drawing the maps and filling in the details? And where are you thinking about leaving the blanks and the room to play at the table?
You know, I feel like I really want to split the difference, which I'm sure everyone feels like they're just in the Goldilocks sweet spot. But, because I know that my impulse is to over prep and over map. And so I know that the needle's going to edge that way. But I also know that... yeah, that does lead to too much furniture in the room or too much the sort of claustrophobic walls all around me. So I do try to push against that. But as I said, when I first read this advice, knowing my own inclinations, I did try to go all the way in the other direction and leave lots of blanks and almost no map. And I didn't love that either. So I do think there's cons the other direction, right?
Yeah, because if you've got nothing to go on, if you sit down to play Dungeons & Dragons without any kind of prep or any kind of module, when the characters or players are done making their characters, like, now what? You know, like you need something to like kind of build on here, right?
Yeah. So much of the juice can come from that existing situation. And that's something, you know, it's interesting because that's across the board, right? Like story games, you want to start with an interesting kind of conceit or situation. And so much of like OSR adventures is about an interesting sort of starting situation and prepping situations, not plots. And so I do think that's kind of universal advice. And that does imply, like, to take the broader sense of mapping, like mapping something out to some extent, to having something there to work around.
Well, the thing that's really interesting to me about you saying that is how much my taste on this changes as I get deeper into a campaign. because at the start of a campaign, I kind of do need to do like a lot more prep to build up all this stuff for us to then play with. But then once you're 6 sessions into a campaign, it's like all that work is done. You know, like I don't feel like I need to draw more maps in the same way, because then I'm going to start feeling claustrophobic. We already have so many toys to play with, you know, and I start leaning more towards leaving blanks as much in prep as I can, because we're filling in more and more details at the table.
Yeah, it's like the momentum has picked up. Something I've been thinking about recently is like, it's almost like gears in a car or on a bike or something. It's like that map and legwork and prep is like low gear. You can't go as fast, but you're getting the momentum going. But once you're flying, you just want to be high gear, like minimal friction and just blasting.
Yeah, totally. So we're kind of having this conversation here about, you know, you prep too much, you map too much, you're going to get feel like hemmed in, you know, you're going to feel you don't have room to maneuver. And if you don't prep enough, if you don't draw enough maps, then you don't have a leg to stand on. Like it's, you have like blue sky syndrome kind of thing. Yeah. But do you think there are other pros and cons to one approach here or the other?
I think they both have different pros and cons. I think there's also an aspect of just the way any given person's brain works and the things they find easy or hard, like the legwork map end of the spectrum, the prep. For some people, that's really helpful during the session, but for other people, that quickly feels like homework, and lots of people hate homework. And as you're saying, once the campaign gets into it, I don't want to have to stop to read 3 paragraphs about the new place we're going. I just want to keep going and keep digging into things. So that's kind of the con of too much prep. And then on the blank part, likewise, for some people, that feeling of being at the table and you go somewhere or meet someone and you know nothing about them, you have no map, you have no prep, that could be very... Some people improvise freely and love it, and other people find that very stressful.
Right. I think on a player side, there's really different tastes there also. Because, you know, if you're leaving a lot of blanks, that can end up feeling like an invitation to contribute to the world building, right? Like when my players are in a fantasy game and they just like run off into the woods and I didn't prep anything in the woods, maybe I'm like, okay, is someone here know an NPC who lives in the woods? Like what's in these woods? What stories did you hear about as children about what's in these woods? Let's figure something out together. But some players, I think, want the world to feel like it exists. Like some people are really playing role-playing games because they want to have the experience of stepping into another world and having the walls of that world like hold up well. And when they show up at a place and they can tell the GM is just kind of like making up off the top of their head, the world feels like it's made of cotton candy. Like nothing means anything, nothing matters. And that also is just such a taste dial. Like I think there are some people who really love both sides of that.
For sure. Even again, to come back to like gears or expectations of a given game or system, there's a difference between sitting down and knowing you're playing a sort of more collaborative game where you're all going to contribute to the fiction versus playing a game where the GM has spun the world around you and it's all felt very fleshed out and real. And then you open a particular door and suddenly the GM is asking you, oh, I don't know, what do you think's in there? Like if there's a sudden shift to that, it can feel quite jarring. But I think if it's there from the start, it's much more, there's something in there as well. I remember I was running a Blades campaign and I'd been doing more of the prep heavy stuff, like less player input. But we were running this sort of session that I hadn't had much time to prep for, and they were in a mansion, and in this mansion I had sketched out a rough map of some of the areas, and one of them was like a trophy room, and one of the players wanted to go there just to see what weird Blades in the Dark trophies would be in there. But I hadn't prepped anything, so I asked them to come up with stuff, but I could feel the kind of like deflation and disappointment because they wanted to see the cool stuff. They didn't want to come up with the cool stuff.
Yeah, it's taste, it's expectation. How are you thinking about this as a designer then? Because, you know, I think that we're talking about this originally in Dungeon World as like MC advice, right? As Dungeon Master advice, or as even like player advice. You know, I think you can take these same principles and apply them to your own character or like backstory when you're doing player character creation. But the designer feels like an important voice at the table too, right? Like the reason that I'm picking up an adventure module to run Cairn is because I don't want to do that work myself, you know? Like I have a day job. Like I want someone else to write a cool ass dungeon for me because they're more talented than I am. And that means you as the designer are coming in and contributing to how much maps, how many blanks are left like in a module, in a work of fiction. And I want to hear your thoughts like generally, but maybe also get into what it was like to take Blades in the Dark and be like, well, I can flesh this out more, you know, like that, but this isn't calibrated to the right level for me. I want to go deeper, you know?
Yeah. It's interesting because it's definitely the same conversation writ large. Like there is an impulse to sort of be generous as a game designer, I think. And like if the potential hypothetical GM or table is looking for a given map or a given write-up, you want that to be there for them. You don't want them to feel like they've been left in the lurch and they have to do your legwork for you. So I do try to like think about that, yeah, spirit of generosity, I suppose. Like I'm going to do this work now and hopefully that will save people work in future and make this game easier to run and people have more fun. But I do think, obviously, you know, even though it's in the spirit of generosity, all that legwork and material can very easily become homework again. It can become stuff that the GM feels they have to read and have to memorize. And that's not fun. I don't like that either. So, you know, trying to, yeah, just find that balance and just really interrogate it. Because in a way, it can feel sort of lazy to leave things out and to leave blanks, but obviously those blanks can be very fruitful. And so it's just like interrogating, am I leaving this blank intentionally, or is it just easier for me to leave this blank? Would it be better filled in? Because I think there can be a laziness to just filling stuff in as well. Like you can just, it's not that hard to just come up with more stuff.
Sure. And this is what I'm always saying about like modules too, is like, I don't want a supplement that's going to give me 20 random barkeeper names because I can come up with a barkeeper name, you know, like if you want to give me one, that's fine that I can like use. Sure. Great. But like when you're offering like 10 adventures in the bar, like a D10 random table of adventures or whatever, I don't need kill the rats in the cellar. Like we've done that for decades, you know, like you don't need to fill in those gaps for me. Like if you're gonna fill in the gaps, I want them to be interesting, something that I would not have come up with myself.
Yeah. It's like all design, right? Graphic design or game design. I mean, this is kind of, I don't know, setting design, I suppose, the kind of maps and lore of it all. But like with game design, obviously I think we'd all agree that you don't want to just keep adding rules for the sake of it. But at the same time,
well, most people would agree, but
so it's just about the right amount and designed well so they, you know, hopefully have a lot of like leverage, like, you know, do a lot with a little, that kind of thing. And even graphic design wise, like I think about that as well. Like coming from a graphic design background, you think about white space on the page, and I hate layouts without enough white space. But working professionally, a lot of clients and a lot of people sort of have this allergic reaction to white space, and they think it's wasted opportunity. And so you really have to defend against that. And I do think like the blanks of the maps is the kind of white space of the design, if you like. And it's so important in terms of the like the composition and letting things breathe and all that stuff.
Yeah. It's interesting to take this and apply it to that too, because of course it applies there. I'm putting out a game called Band-Aids and Bullet Holes in a couple of months in May. In that game, like a lot of my work actually has been like thinking I need more rules than I do. I want people to have like enough levers to pull, or like, you know, they'll come up to a particular point of friction over and over again, and I want to have an answer for them there. But also sometimes you're like putting in too much and then people don't use the tools, or they get confused by the tools, or they run afoul somehow. Like you're saying in graphic design too, like leaving blanks so that people can kind of like process the thing feels important.
Yeah, for sure. And for me, the trick is that I think when you're excited about design, another mistake you can make is to feel like the best way to do your thing is to like go for the extreme. So like if you have discovered the beauty of white space and the fruitful void and this kind of stuff, it can be easy to sort of make yourself minimalist and just think, I'm going to use the absolute like minimum I can. And it's kind of like a design exercise in a way. It's like you're challenging yourself. And I would have definitely had those phases as well, but I kind of think the answer is probably somewhere in the middle, as much fun as it is to kind of go through the exercise of either total maximalism or total minimalism. Like,
got her.
Here we go.
Oh my God. He threw, the chair.
He threw the chair.
And now he's getting it back because we're going to have to sit.
We are in Casey's home. That was Casey's actual chair.
You look out of the window and you see a Toyota Previa upside down on fire.
Oh my God. Oh.
But it's not nearby any trees or anything, so it's fine.
On fire.
It's fine. It's not fine to me, GM. Jesus Christ, that's my fucking car.
Dynamite headbutt.
He screams as he headbutts this man.
Honestly, his left jaundiced eyeball pops out of his head.
Oh! And if you were to take a picture the second their two heads were touching, it might have been an intimate, tender scene between friends or lovers. But if you were to take a picture at any other second, yeah, it is just absolutely horrifying.
For some men, violence is a form of intimacy, which is so sad.
That is
maybe
so
for
sad.
This man. But anyway. Boom! Smashed in the head!
Bodhi has a pocket full of, like, one oversized precious moment angel that has a real strange face.
Oh, I thought that was your dick.
Oh! It was his dick. There's a hole in his pocket and his penis, which does resemble a precious moment angel with a strange face.
Oh, it's a strange face, but it actually looks like a pretty normal penis head.
And that's what we call facts.
He looks back and he says one last threatening phrase, pointing into the bar.
I'm gonna... And Violet shoots him in the head.
You see this guy's ear get blown off, flying off his head.
Ah! Bye-bye.
And then at this point, Scratch pops up like a mummy.
Ah, mummy! Headbutt! Dynamite headbutt!
Something is rising, piecing itself together from the bodies and viscera around it. Its black wings spread, and it looks back at you with red, wet eyes.
Got her.
I want to bring us back to your maps of Duskwall for Blades in the Dark. So for me, Blades in the Dark is like perfectly calibrated to what I want in terms of like level of detail. That I think the list of districts and factions in particular, I cannot tell you how many times I've just like read over those pages and gotten or skimmed them over in the middle of a session and like been able to pull out something that I need. And one of the things I love about them is that like each individual one is like pretty bite-sized, you know, like the districts are like a two-page spread, but there's like half of that is art, if not more, or like little graphical details. The factions are like half a page each typically, and like those are, you know, there's a lot of info crammed in there with the font size, but like, you know, it's a similar thing where it's like you're meeting someone from this faction, there's a list of NPCs, here we go. I like that there's a lot of each of those things too. So like when I'm sitting down to play Blades, you know, there's like 25 factions or something laid out in the book, and the game is kind of asking me to just pick my favorite three of them, you know, so I can pick my favorite three, find a way that they're all yelling at each other, and then like later in the campaign, if it feels like maybe we need someone else, maybe I like go back and skim through the factions and find another to bring in or whatever. But it's a lot of choice, but also a lot of stuff that is like easily falls away. You know, I feel like that's a nice way to handle the balance here, right? Of like, John drew a lot of maps, but each individual map has a lot of blanks on it, right? And then you were like, yeah, but we need like really detailed like cartography. I'm gonna like block by block like map out the whole city, which for me is like too much. Like I respect the absolute hell out of your maps, but I was like, if we're on a score and it becomes clear that it would be cool if next door there was like a slaughterhouse or something, then like now there's a slaughterhouse next door. And if we're using your maps, we like can't do that. And so I'm curious to hear you just like talk through your taste in providing that level of detail. Like what you like detail more than me. What do you like about it in particular?
You know, I feel like there's a bit of preamble to the answer, which is, so I work an Atlas, co-authored an Atlas before, and I work in my day job is in GIS adjacent, so like Google Maps, that kind of stuff. And so I don't tend to think, you know, maybe this is controversial, I don't think of my maps as necessarily more detailed. I think of them as a different zoom level. So zoom all the way out on Google Maps or any mapping software, all the detail disappears and you just get national borders and country names. And then as you zoom in, more detail starts appearing, like major roads, cities, states. And then if you zoom in more, you start to get, you know, minor roads and suburbs and things like this. And we're all just kind of used to that, but it's actually quite fiddly. Well, I know that from experience, having designed some of these things, like it's really fiddly to say at the zoom level, you have to show this and it looks like this. And then at the next zoom level, you have to do that. Like it doesn't just happen. Someone has to go in and find all these things. But it's so important because depending on your zoom level, you want a different level of detail. Like if you showed everything at the national, at the global level, it would just look bonkers. It would, you know, if you showed every minor road, it would be illegible. But if you show nothing when you're zoomed in, then all you see is blank maps. So you need to get that zoom level just right. So that's a long-winded way of saying, you know, when John Harper was working on Flame Without Shadow, the Blue Coat supplement a few years ago, they released a detailed map of Coleridge to go along with it, because that supplement came with a starting situation that was entirely sort of set in this one district of Coleridge. And I mean, I don't know John's thought process, but the way I read that was that if you're going to have a whole campaign set in this one district instead of the whole city, you want more fidelity because you're more zoomed in. Like the maps as presented in the book at a district, if you're just focused on one district, you don't really get anything below that. So you don't know suburb names, you don't know much about the internal geography. And so, yeah, at that kind of like single district campaign level, John obviously felt it was beneficial to have this like zoomed in map and to render things at a new level. I think it's totally in keeping with the higher map, by which I mean, although it labels streets and suburbs, what it doesn't do is, to go back to your slaughterhouse example, it doesn't tell you where all these businesses are. It doesn't actually define a lot more. It just gives you street names and suburb names, which to my mind, I mean, to go back to your question of like the intentionality of designing this stuff, something I do ask is this something that would be fun to improvise at the table, or is this boring legwork? And I think coming up with a street name or a suburb name is kind of boring, and I'd rather just have that there. Like, I don't need to invent a new Coleridge suburb on the spot. I'm happy for the game to give me that. And so I think John's map for Coleridge did that really well. And so, not to decredit myself, but all I thought was, you know, I'm running a very zoomed in Bravo campaign at the time set in Crowsfoot, and I wanted that same zoomed in experience because I knew I wanted to do like a lot of Peaky Blinders turf war stuff, like block by block. And so I wanted to know like what street corners they held and what suburbs they were based in and where the other gangs of Crowsfoot were based. And I wanted that higher level of fidelity. And so I did Crowsfoot, and then people liked that. And so I started doing more, and then I ended up doing the whole city. But it was always the intention that they are used to zoom into one district, not necessarily to always look at the whole city in that level of detail. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. And, you know, another thing that makes me think of, like, the map levels thing makes me think of is one of the things that I like about Blades in the Dark is it kind of leaves it open-ended, like, how big is Duskwall as a city? You know, like, maybe it's the size of New York, and maybe it's the size of Minneapolis. And, like, those are two really, really different Duskwalls, right? And I like the idea of looking at your detailed maps and being like, well, are we at the all the way zoomed in level, or are we at like a mid-tier level, like between the all the way out and the all the way in? Like, are we actually, when I look at the map of Char Hollow here that I opened up on my computer, like, is Pissing Alley and Flenser's Way, like, those are like right next to each other, but are there additional alleys between the two of those? Like, maybe, like, that you can kind of maybe make that decision for yourself also, like, are we zoomed in all the way yet or not?
I think there's certainly a big part of that. I mean, something I sort of struggle with to some extent is, like, the book makes a big deal about how multi-level Duskwall is, and you can't really show that on a two-dimensional map. So, I mean, there are like blanks here in terms of what's the subterranean map look like, and what does the sort of first story and third story. Yeah, there is a lot of like detail that is implied but not shown, I think.
That's very interesting.
I mean, another example, just because I've been thinking about it with Blade 68, is a question I see a lot on like the Blades Reddit and Discord and other places is people want to know which gangs are based where in the city. And John kind of gestured at this loosely in Deep Cuts, but in general, I think they've been pretty reluctant to say like this gang is specifically here. And I think that kind of shows some of this draw maps leave blanks tension, where people want granularity of knowing exactly who is where across the city. But it totally works against you at the table because, I mean, to your earlier point, like, as the campaign progresses, you want to just be able to grab a faction you find interesting and throw them into the mix and not have to worry about, oh, well, the gang have chosen to base themselves in Six Towers, but this gang is based in Silkshore, so it doesn't really work. And, you know,
Yeah, well, and that gets back to my thing about like Cotton Candy World earlier, right? Where like that is what you were describing is how I want to be able to run Blades, and I think how my tables typically do. But I do know other people who are like, no, I want all that info because like I want to be able to look at the map and be like, well, you're not fighting with those people because they're in Silkshore. You're fighting with the Dimmer Sisters because they're right next to you in 6 hours, right? Like they want those answers so the world feels like, air quotes, realer to them, you know?
Yeah, it's kind of like another sort of slightly tortured analogy, but you know, there's these like movie YouTube essays about great heist scenes and action scenes, and often they focus in on the way the good ones will like set up a location ahead of the heist scene or the action scene so that you as the viewer know like, oh, there's a basement here and a window there, and everything's very consistent across shots and everyone working on it understands that location and all the moving parts like clockwork. And so when the action scene happens, you as a viewer kind of get, even just subconsciously, that satisfaction of understanding everything that's going on rather than just randomly having someone like jump through a window and you're like, where did that window come from? And this kind of chaotic feeling. And so I think that's kind of like the draw map side of things. But, you know, a lot of other shows are all blanks, and I think that works really well for them too, like especially more like I was thinking about soap operas, like, you know, like if you've got a show set in a hospital, there's no map of that hospital. And on any given episode, the arrangement is whatever is most interesting for the story. Or X-Men, like obviously there are maps of the mansion, but really on any given arc, the mansion is laid out. However,
in which ocean is the evil island that we're going to this week also, yeah. Right? You know, like.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's a ton of examples in that vein as well, where like, you know, whatever that vagueness lets you just make whatever is the most dramatic, interesting choice for today's story.
Yeah. So I want to take all of that and like bring it back into the context of Blade 68, because I feel like you are doing a version of this with Blade 68, where you are taking like the established world of Duskwall and you're changing it significantly. That's like the big difference in what you've been doing with Blade 68, is like the first thing that you're doing is twisting everything. But then I think you also are like providing a lot more detail in all of this, and not just in the literal map of the districts that you made before, but also in terms of, okay, let's take Skurlock from the original Blades, like what's Skurlock up to now, or like which factions have ebbed and which factions have flowed, you know, like what all let's riff on the past, but in doing so get deeper into it. What has been different about that process for you, and what's been the most compelling stuff for you to like dive deeper into as you're exploring the fiction more?
Yeah, I mean, I have been aware that there's a lot here. Obviously, the page count is like 450 or roughly, which is like bigger than Blades, which is sort of absurd for an expansion that doesn't even contain the core rules. Like, so I am aware that like there's a lot here. I mean, I think it is all in that spirit of hopefully generosity. And, you know, it's like Blade 68 is kind of a stretch. Like it's kind of off the wall idea in a way. Like Blades in the Dark is this quite grim, dark 19th century setting, quintessentially like industrial fantasy, Victorian, steampunk even, with a very dark premise, like a post-apocalyptic fantasy world with eternal night and the gates of death have been broken and et cetera, et cetera. So the idea of like a swinging 60s version of that is a stretch. It's a stretch. And I think that contrast is part of the appeal of the pitch, is like, you know, that's unexpected. That's fun. It's quite literally, it's like something you only ever knew as black and white and then seen it in color. It's like kind of mind-blowing. But because it is such a stretch, I felt like I wanted to really offer a lot of that support, and not just to kind of say, what if we did Blades and Dark in the 60s and then throw the ball to the GM. Like I wanted to make sure
you want to give them like a mitt to catch the ball with, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or like a net behind them or something. So that's kind of how I see it, is like, yes, it leads more into a sort of maximalist approach a little bit. Like there's more factions, more districts, but I hope it's all helpful. And I mean, the other thing I'd say is to go back to your point about how clever the presentation of the Blades in the Dark, like factions and districts and setting, if you like. And I totally agree. And I think it's one of those like parts of Blades in the Dark that I kind of wish was copied more. Like obviously Forged in the Dark exploded, but I think the presentation of, in terms of the content edit and, but also the graphic design and layout and the way things are chopped up, like that's so innovative and effective. I think it's really worth copying. And so as soon as I was doing Blade 68, I was like, I'm definitely going to follow that format. And I don't, you know, I think of Blades in the Dark as like kind of a grab bag, right? Like, as you're saying, you just grab out a few factions and you throw them on the table and that's what you're playing with. And so I don't really see Blades in the Dark as homework. And so that kind of gave me permission to add more to the grab bag, because it doesn't feel to me like I'm adding homework to someone's plate. It feels like I'm just giving them a bigger grab bag to pull out of. And that's kind of the spirit I tried to maintain.
Yeah, I've been thinking for a couple of months now about what I'm calling Apollo 47 core.
Yeah, I have this noted down. I want to talk about this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, wait, people who listened to last week, we kind of got into this a lot there also, but Apollo 47 is this game by Tim Hutchings that's like your astronauts doing boring space stuff because you're on the 47th Apollo mission, not the 11th anymore or whatever. And the game has like, you know, 1 or 10 pages of rules or something, and then like 500 pages of like technical manual from like NASA that you could like flip through and be like, oh yeah, I'm like talking about like whatever kind of bolt this is or whatever. And like the point of the game is that you are just talking about like boring shit while you're up there. But I think this is like, that's the most like maximalist extreme version of something that I'm seeing a lot, you know, in games like Wander Home. I think it's like big with this, right? Where you have like initial playbooks, but then like so much of that book is just NPC traits and location stuff, and then you're combining those things in different combinations to like create places and people that you're going to go deal with. Or Mythic Bastion Land is the other like big example here for me of like, that game is 20 pages, 25 pages of rules and 72 knights, 72 myths, like a bunch of NPCs. Each of those 72 knight and myth pages has like someone's name at the bottom and like an idea for an omen and, you know, all this other kind of crap. It's just like, most of the book is, here's a grab bag for you to pull from. I think that the grab bag is like a great way of describing it. It's been really interesting to look back and realize how much Blades was that and is that and is doing that, that it, the factions work exactly like that, right? The lists of scores and NPCs and stuff, like it might not go as extreme as Mythic Bastion Land, but like a huge section of the book is dedicated to that stuff, and I think that stuff is super, super valuable. Like when I sit down to play any game, it's important to me what system we are using to play that game, but also the like fiction, like where are we, like that stuff is also so important. And games that are coming packed to the gills with that stuff also, like, then that gives you direction on how to use the mechanical portions of the game too, you know. It's like, how do we like combine the peanut butter and chocolate of those things to push forward?
Yeah, it's such a clever way to hit that sweet spot as well in terms of homework. Like I think about the way John, both the districts but especially the factions, like that section, because Blade 68 is trying to evoke the graphic design of Blades in the Dark. I've been looking at that book a lot. And the way the faction section starts with a table of all the factions, and then after that is a short description of all the factions, and then after that is all the detailed write-ups. And it's kind of like a cascade of, like, if you really hate homework, you can just use the table. You don't have to read anymore. You just grab something off the table and make some stuff up. If you want a bit more, you can read the little one-paragraph blurb. And if you want more, you jump to the full write-up, which is still, as you say, only like half a page. But this kind of cascading thing. The districts too, that section starts with an overview of the whole city and a paragraph on each district, which gives you enough. Like, you know, White Crown is the richest district. Most people have never set foot there. That's kind of all you need. But then if you do want more, you can jump to that page and grab a bit more. So that kind of, that sort of sliding scale of how much you use that stuff is so clever, I think.
The other thing that's really wonderful about that stuff in Blades is it's a template. You know, if you're making your own factions, like, oh, here are some things you might want to include in that faction, right? You might want to know who's in charge or who the important players are, some rivals, like maybe roughly where they're based, their assets, and like what their goals are. Okay, cool. That's what a faction looks like. Now when I'm like coming up with the new gang that's coming up based on the rivals that the PCs fucked over in the first season, you know, like I know what to put together for myself.
Yeah, that is really clever. And I think if you kind of put it into that format, you start to see if you're going wrong, because it's like, oh, I've got three pages, and this it's not what they look like in the book, so maybe I've done too much.
Yeah. But it's also true that, you know, like, then sort of the challenge of the way they're formatted in the book is, like, you're going to take these, and you're going to fill in more of the blanks. Like, the point is, here's half a page, but, like, by the time you're six sessions into a campaign, like, I know a lot more about who the leader of the Crows is, you know, like we've met that person, like they've died, and like they're a ghost now, and they're lieutenants also, then we've added all these other NPCs involved, and like you are constantly like filling in more of those blanks as you go.
For sure. To go back to like what's boring legwork and what's interesting, the Reality Wardens, for example, they get their half page write up. I'm sure John could have written a whole book of cool Reality Warden powers and assets and things they have. But the point being, that's all like cool stuff and it's fun to come up with. And I think any GM, if they need to give a Reality Warden some powers, that's fun to come up with yourself and to build that out to your own tastes. And so that's left as a blank. And it kind of goes back to like what might have benefited Dungeon World more is, you know, we're talking about how kind of short and high level that advice is really. Like you almost kind of want like an example of how much map and how much blank. Like, what does draw maps, leave blanks even mean? Which I think Blades does successfully, yeah.
Yeah, totally. We talked about a lot of interesting things, but it is interesting to me that everything always comes back to in this conversation, it's just a matter of taste. It's like, none of this stuff is wrong, you know? It's like, this is something that is going to benefit you when you approach it with strong intention, that like all, you know, how you, only you can know for yourself what's the right amount of prep to do or blanks to leave, or, you know, and maybe it's different for literal maps versus NPCs for you, or whatever the thing is. Like, it's, these are dials. It's cool to know the dials exist. It's fun to experiment turning the dials one way or another. And also, like, probably you're going to find the level that you are most comfortable at.
Yeah. And I think it kind of goes back to your question about how you approach this differently as a designer versus a GM. Like, as a GM, you just put in the amount of detail, you know, works for you and your table. And that's not easy, but, you know, it's kind of straightforward. But as a designer, it is more to go to your Apollo 47 core thing. It's like, I think the way forward is to build in that responsiveness and that dynamic approach and to really make it so that people can dial that in how they want. Like, if you think about the trad games or whatever, like, I don't know, the worst examples of D&D adventures or whatever, like, you do have to read it all, and it is all dense, and it's not modular, and it is a lot of homework. And yeah, so that, I mean, I'm playing Mythic Bastion Land at the moment, and I think Mythic Bastion Land is a great example as well, because I've been busy on Blaze 68, that book did, it would have felt like homework to read that whole book. I didn't have time to read a whole book, but I haven't read all the myths or all the knights, and I just roll on the table and read the one that's relevant, and it works fine. It's great.
Yeah, I think it is actually, it's especially interesting to me in all of these examples, but especially like Wander Home, how there are a bunch of pieces that are meant to be combined into something new for you. Like, you know, in Mythic Bastion Land, you see that with the myths of like, hey, you're going to use a half dozen of these tops and you're going to like put them onto a map. And that's, you know, you can find someone who's done that online. You can find the Tim Denae of Mythic Bastion Land or whatever and do that. Or, you know, you put six of them on the map, but then they're going to start like smacking against each other. They're going to be doing like crazy crap together that like the designer never expected, because like, you know, it's unpredictable. People will do crazy crap. And that like mashing up of these modular pieces, there's just so much juice in that. And like the more disassembled they become as pieces, the more obvious I think that it is that you are supposed to mash them together and like create something new out of them. And that as a designer, maybe there's something to that, you know, and to like, I think in the Hard Zones, Apocalypse World 3rd Edition, like they come with a like, here are some locations that might be in the Frozen Wastes. Like all of these exist, but maybe you'll never find half a dozen of them or whatever, or throw some of them out. You know, like there's a little bit of that, like, here's this like resource if you need it. And then like the fact that in this instance of the game, like the Rim and Sword Town are right next to each other makes it feel really different from like when they're really far away or when one doesn't exist at all. And like the same is true of Blades factions. The same is true of everything else.
Yeah, that kind of palette approach. And I think what's really powerful in all this to me as well is that, you know, when we were first talking about this episode, it's easy to kind of think of draw maps, leave blanks along a sort of like almost OSR story game spectrum where like OSR adventures are a lot of map and often come with maps, and you know, a lot of what I think of as story games are very improvised and more on the blank end. But actually there's no such axis, and like Mythic Bastion Land comes from the OSR tradition and it's extremely like draw maps, leave blanks. Literally, like when you draw your map, it's full of like blank spaces to allow the myths to happen. And you know, a lot of that OSR tradition of like random tables all the way down, like that's essentially the same kind of like providing that modular content that you sort of bring to the table and fuse, and you get that juice at the table from assembling it yourself.
Yeah, and I think a lot of Blades is built on that kind of thing too, right? Yeah. Tim, thanks for being on Dice.
Hey, what a pleasure. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks again to Tim for being here. Blade 68 is on BackerKit right now, and you can find everything else Tim at olddog.games. Thanks to everyone who supports Dice Exploder on Patreon. As always, you can find me on Blue Sky at Dice Exploder, and you can find my games at sdunnewald.itch.io. Our logo was designed by Sporgery, our theme song is Sunset Bridge by Purely Gray, and our ad music is Lily Pads by my boy, Travis Tesmer. This episode was edited by Emma Costa. Thank you, Em, and thanks to you for listening. See you next time.